Hello and welcome. This is the Yaron Brook Show, and this is Ilan Jurnos sitting in for Yaron. So if you're new to the program, welcome. You probably know who Yaron is just from reading about him and from listening to the show. And if you are new, you should know that what we talk about here is Ayn Rand's ideas and their application to the world and the culture and politics. If you're new to me, if you haven't heard of me before, it's great to be with you. I hope you enjoy the show. I work at the Ayn Rand Institute alongside Yaron. I'm a fellow and I have the role of director of policy research. Basically, I write and speak about Ayn Rand's ideas, and my area of specialty is foreign policy. And I'm going to talk about some stories in the news lately that fall into that area. Just to give you a quick preview, there have been a number of developments that caught my attention, and I want to kind of dig into them. Three that come to mind are, there's a report that came out in the fall about anti-Muslim extremism, and there's a list of people who have been isolated as belonging in that category and tarred as Islamophobes. So I want to look at that report and the issues surrounding it. Then, not long ago, Cuba's longtime dictator Fidel Castro died. And there's a really interesting issue there that I want to pick apart and talk about, because I think it's one that bears further thought, even if Castro is finally buried and in the ground, not a moment too soon. And the third issue is a development I read about happening in Europe, specifically in Poland, that I think has some lessons for us here in the U.S. now that there's a Republican control of Congress basically coming up, and obviously Donald Trump's administration taking office soon. So those are the headlines of what I want to cover. I hope you get to all of them. And before we do that, I want to say a couple of things about sort of the structure for the show today. So I'm going to cover those topics, but I want to do it in a special way. I want to frame those issues from a particular perspective. And in effect, I want to show you the links, or some of the links, between those issues and the topics we're going to talk about and writings that Ayn Rand put out many, many years ago. And I mean, as in 40, 45 plus years ago. And that might sound strange, but I think if you bear with me, you'll see that the connections are really strong. And the reason I'm doing this, one of the reasons here, is I think there's a lot of value to be gained from reading Ayn Rand's nonfiction essays in her many books. And one of the things I find is that a lot of people who are fans of Ayn Rand or admirers of her work, or even really committed to understanding it or applying it in their own lives, I think I've met people and the amount of reading they've done, it varies, but my impression is they haven't read as much as they could, and they're not getting the full benefit of what they are reading. So in effect, what I'm trying to sell you on is the value of reading these essays and understanding their application to your own life now, here in the present, even if some of the details and the issues she wrote about so many decades ago have passed into history, there are timeless philosophic insights and lessons that are still there to be gleaned and applied and used. And those are really valuable in your own life. They enable you to gain control of your own thinking, clarify your thought, and lead a happier, more successful life. And I think that's ultimately the value of Ayn Rand's philosophy. It's a means for success in your own life and happiness. She called it the philosophy for living on earth. And I think it's a really profound identification. So that's basically the setup for today. I want to talk about those issues and frame them from the perspective of a couple of articles that Ayn Rand wrote some time ago. So let's dig in with the first story that came out in October. Now, I don't know how many people noticed this, but it definitely came up on my radar. And it was a big deal, and I think there are going to be ripple effects from this even after the story has faded from the headlines. So there's an organization that you may or may not have heard about called the Southern Poverty Law Center. And in October, it put out a report called The Field Guide to Anti-Muslim Extremists. And the subtitle for this was A Journalist's Guide. Now, I know a little about the Southern Poverty Law Center. It has an interesting history, and I'll say a bit about that. But what I want to talk about in analyzing this is what exactly is meant here by anti-Muslim extremism. Who are the people on this list? What is the rationale for this list? And what is the actual purpose of this report? So the declared purpose is to help journalists sort out who are good people to go to for comment and analysis on certain issues related to Islam and Islamist threat. But what is the actual purpose? Because I think that requires a bit more analysis than what is said on the page. So the issues that come up here are, I think the main one is flagged in the headline. What is anti-Muslim extremism? What is extremism? And I put that in air quotes. And then related to that, and as the report indicates, it treats the issue of Islamophobia as a legitimate concept. And I think it should be a concept people question rather than take for granted. So what does that actually mean, and what clarity does that give to thought, if any? And I think the answer is it doesn't. Now, that's the report. And what brought this to my attention, not only is this report interesting in its own right, but it was, so the Southern Poverty Law Center is well respected. And from what I understand, for some good reasons, given its history and the sort of things that it used to do. But the report itself elicited real criticism. And I think people were astonished at the individuals who are noted here. And you'll see in a moment what I mean by that. So it's a real motley crew of people. Some people that you might say, hey, these sound like total bigots. And then other people that are really substantive critics of jihadism, many of them actually. And people whose own personal histories vindicate their credibility. Because these people who really understand what they're talking about, they've seen it firsthand, they've experienced it. So in what sense do they belong on this list? So there's a real outcry and criticism about this report. And I'll dig into that a little bit more in a second. But I want to connect this to an essay that Ayn Rand wrote called Philosophical Detection. And it is published in 1974. That's before I was born. Sheesh. And it appears, you can find it in the book Philosophy Who Needs It. So the article is Philosophical Detection. It's an excellent essay. And I'm going to encourage you to read it, of course, but I'm going to flag a few aspects of it. Now, one of the values of that essay is Ayn Rand's guidance on how to think and understand the world and to see the significance of philosophical ideas and their meaning and how to guard against irrational ones and how to sort out what is an irrational idea and what is its impact on you. So it's her how-to guide in a sense. And it really came to mind when I was reading this report from the Southern Poverty Law Center, because practically every paragraph is loaded with terms and philosophical ideas that need to be questioned. So one of the things that Ayn Rand offers in her essay, Philosophical Detection, is guidance on what to do when you hear something that is essentially a philosophical position or a value normative claim, an evaluation of somebody, and how to sort out what to make of it. So, for example, when you hear things like there's a problem with anti-Muslim extremism, what exactly does that mean? Are we talking about people who destroy property, vandalize property, who threaten or carry out attacks against Muslim individuals, which are real crimes and there's no place for them in a free society or any society? I mean, those are violations of individual rights. Or do you mean something else? And I think part of what comes out from this report is it's not clear what it means. And I think in my view, there is really no objective meaning to the term anti-Muslim extremism. And the key term here is extremism. So part of what comes to mind here is, well, how do you sort out what is going on here? And there are two things I want to highlight in talking about this report and then some of the other stories today. And they both come from Ayn Rand's how-to essay, Philosophical Detection. And the two issues are, basically, there's more to her essay, of course, than I'm going to cover, but the two points I want to highlight are, number one, that it's really crucial to be clear about the definition of terms. Really, what does it mean? What does it refer to in the world? So something like extremism, that's a very a key term that we're going to dig into here. And her advice here is, don't translate a term when you meet one. Don't translate it. Don't glamorize it. Don't make the mistake of thinking, oh, as many people do, oh, nobody could possibly mean this, and then proceed to endow it with some whitewashed meaning of your own. Take it straight for what it does say and mean. So she's saying that when you find a term that seems freighted or loaded with meaning, philosophical meaning, significance, and value significance, don't try to import what you think it means. Just take it straight. Figure out what it's supposed to refer to in the world, and then evaluate it. So, as she says in other places as well, define your terms. Really be, so that's one aspect of what it means to engage in philosophical detection. The second one that I want to highlight today is what she says in the following paragraph in this essay, which is, when you find a term or an idea or a policy that you encounter, The way to start thinking about it and to evaluate it is to ask yourself, if I had took this seriously, if I really tried to live by this, or if we try to implement this in the world, what would it really look like? What would its impact be on my life, on human life in general? What would society look like if it were shaped according to this idea? And it's another way to think of this is to take ideas seriously means to take them personally, to see their significance to your life and the values that you care about. And we'll see that especially in some of the stories I'm going to cover later on. So let's circle back to this issue of, so the two aspects I want to highlight are being clear about the definition of terms and what that means. And it's not a semantic issue, let's be pedantic about the terms and pull out the dictionary. It's important to be clear what you're referring to. But what she's getting at more deeply than just the meaning of words in the dictionary is, what is the conception here? What is the idea? What does it refer to in the world? So this is an issue about being clear about the concepts that we use. And the second one is the meaning, the personal significance of ideas and as a way into evaluating them. So with that, let's circle back to this report and kind of understand what's going on here and zoom in on this issue of extremism, anti-Muslim extremism. So I mentioned some of what this report is purporting to do, which is to tell journalists, hey, here's a bunch of people who are just beyond the pale. They are extremists. And again, I'm using that term throughout with scare quotes. And don't talk to them, talk to someone else. That's the advice here. And the organization, the Southern Poverty Law Center, is trading on its reputation for having actually done things that on the face of it, and I don't have deep knowledge of what they've done, but from what I've read in the past, they have gone after neo-Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan and taken them to court and effectively caused them such economic damage and through lawsuits that they've crippled branches of the Ku Klux Klan and bankrupted these groups such that they weren't able to function. I mean, we're talking about this happened in the 1970s. The Southern Poverty Law Center went after some white supremacist groups, and in civil suits, they won claims to the tune of $7 and $12 million. And as you can imagine, that would take the wind out of the sails of these organizations. So it's trading on this reputation of having really taken real steps against actual evils in the world, namely the Ku Klux Klan and various white supremacists and neo-Nazis. So that's where the Southern Poverty Law Center has gained some of its standing. And now it's turning to an issue that in its judgment and the organizations that went along with it, because this is a report by several organizations along with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now it's saying to the world, there's a real problem with something called anti-Muslim extremism, and this has to be flagged, and we want to control the debate and dissuade the press from speaking to certain people and speaking to other better people. So that's the premise of this report. So let's take this term extremism. What does it actually mean? What does it mean to be an anti-Muslim extremist? And a lot of people were asking that question at the time the report came out. And the trigger for it, I mean, a lot of people just use that term unthinkingly and unquestioningly, and that's a problem. But what triggered it in this case is that it didn't seem like there was a common thread among the people listed. There are 15 writers and thinkers listed on this report. And several of them really stood out as being reputable and having some standing and not being crazies, in effect, which is what this report is purporting to show, that these are just crazy people, don't talk to them. Well, it's interesting because Ayn Rand has a great deal to say about the term extremism as a device, because I think it is it's a calculated device. It's a term that is concocted and deliberately used. And its purpose, in part, is to really distort thinking and cloud our thinking. And I think it's true in this case of the Southern Poverty Law Center's report. So she has an essay from 1964 called Extremism, in quotes, or The Art of Smearing. And it's a fascinating essay, and it speaks to the emergence of this term extremism in the context of, I think it's the Republican Convention, and the debates about who belongs and who's part of the sort of the right-wing, reputable right-wing organizations. And part of the essay is just identifying how this term came about, but also analyzing what is its actual meaning and what is its purpose, which will surprise some people. Because in loose conversation, when we talk about an extremist, we mean someone who's just out there, right? I mean, what exactly is someone you don't want to deal with? Is it beyond the pale? They've taken steps. They've gone too far. That's what the vague kind of everyday usage of that term means. But that's not helpful to thinking. It wasn't then and it isn't now. And Ayn Rand's analysis at the time, and I think it's true still, and I'm going to connect it to the present issue. Her analysis at the time was that this is what you call a package deal, or a concept that it puts together things that don't go together. And in fact, it was a special kind of a package deal. It's putting together things that are essentially different, or there's no reason to put them together, or that it's corrupting of our thinking to put them together. And so it's not only doing that, which could, in some cases could be a mistake or an error, but it's doing it purposely. It's a way to push out of thought real categories and real concepts that are useful. So she, part of her analysis of extremism is, as her advice later on, is to take it straight. What does it actually mean? And she points out in her essay that nobody at the time of that she was writing, and this is in the 60s now, really was willing to pin down what they meant by extremism, which is significant and suspicious. So she begins her analysis by saying, well, the term extremism by itself doesn't have any meaning. The concept of extreme denotes, and I'm reading here, a relation or a measurement of degree. And skipping a little bit, she says, it speaks to the character or kind of something farthest removed from the ordinary or average, the utmost or exceedingly great in degree. And she's quoting a dictionary here. So to go on, it is obvious that the first question one has to ask before using the term is a degree of what? And here, and this is me speaking again, it's re-significant here, because what is it that is, why is this term so, carry such negative connotations? Because when you really think through what it would look like, the degree to which something is, the degree that you're highlighting could be good or bad, right? So she goes on to answer the extreme of anything, and to proclaim that any extreme is evil because it is an extreme, to hold the degree of a characteristic regardless of its nature as evil is an absurdity. Measurement as such has no value significance, and measurements acquire it only from the nature of that which are being measured. So to give the examples she has here, which I think are telling, are an extreme of health and an extreme of disease equally undesirable? Or take another example here. Is an extreme of intelligence and extreme stupidity both equally far removed from the ordinary average? Are they equally unworthy? Are extreme honesty and extreme dishonesty equally immoral? So, and the essay goes on to analyze the issue in even more depth. But when you take the term straight, when you take it and you try to pin it down, what are you referring to? It's clear it's a cover. It's a way of conveying an evaluation without actually being willing to put one's views on the table. And here, I think part of, to bring it to the issue of the anti-Muslim extremism that this report by Southern Poverty Law Center is criticizing, what's happening here is it's not that the people listed here aren't critical of certain issues out there in the culture. What are they critical of? And what is it that the Southern Poverty Law Center objects to? Well, that's not clear because you have people here, and this is part of what the outrage was about. Here's some of the people on the list that you might have heard about. One of them is Majid Nawaz, and I've read one of his books. He's a thoughtful person. So his backstory is he used to be a recruiter for a jihadist organization. He was really committed. He learned Arabic. He was born in the UK. He learned Arabic to study the Quran. He was in prison in Egypt on charges of fomenting jihadist activity, and he changed his path. He dropped all that, and now he runs a think tank in the UK, and I think he's quite prominent there. And his vision now is, whether you agree with it or not, he's trying to be a reformer within Islam. He wants to say, look, Islam can be part of secular society, and here's arguments for doing that. And I think it's very brave of him to do that because he's basically calling – this can put a target on his back. So he's someone who's a proud Muslim who thinks Islam should be changed in certain ways or that it should accommodate secular life. He, according to this report, and many people were outraged to see, he is considered an extremist. Another example in this report is Ayaan Hirsi Ali, which many people have heard about. She's written a number of books that have sold widely. So her story is she was born in Somalia, and she moved around. She lived in Saudi Arabia for a while. She ended up fleeing from the kind of very traditional religious background that she grew up in, and went to the Netherlands, where she was educated, and she became a member of parliament. Eventually, she left, and she's become a really outspoken critic of the jihadist movement, and specifically, she's critical of the role that Islamic society and culture gives to women and how abhorrent that is. And she, of course, has had for a number of years an actual bounty on her head. She's on an Al-Qaeda hit list. Her colleague, Theo van Gogh, who was a filmmaker in the Netherlands, he was killed by a jihadist specifically for a film that he and Ayaan Hirsi Ali made that was critical. And if you watch the film, it's called Submission. If you watch it, it's remarkably tame, given what you could say about the issues. It's critical of the role that Islam gives to women. So those are the two of many people on this list. Among other people, I'll name people I know, Daniel Pipes, who's a scholar and a historian, and he runs a think tank. He's on this list as an anti-Muslim extremist. And then there are other people that you might have heard of, David Horowitz, who used to be a very hardcore leftist and became a very strident kind of right-wing firebrand. These are four out of the 15 people on the list that are highlighted by this organization. So, and I think of them as reputable and doing important work, and I don't agree with everything they say, or not even most of what they say in some cases, but these are people who deserve a hearing, and in no sense are they doing something, in my view, that is beyond the pale. So that takes us really a step back. What is it that is happening here? So are there people on this list who are in some sense irrational, or bigoted, or racist. And from what I've read, it's possible that some of them are, and some of the views that are summarized here, if they're accurate, and that's the question, are really, some of them are really kooky, and I would regard those, some of those people, as bigots or racists. But you, what happens when you put people like that alongside thoughtful and brave critics like Majid Nawaz and Iron Hirsi Ali and Daniel Pipes? What happens? I think part of what happens is you reveal that this idea of anti-Muslim extremist or extremist is not a legitimate category. It's not a legitimate concept. It's putting together fundamentally different things, because to be critical of jihadists, as I know Daniel Pipes is and Ayan Hirsi Ali is and Majid Nawaz is, that is necessary and important and rational. It's a, as any ideology should be subject, or any religion, or any ideological framework or philosophic framework should and can and should be subject to rational scrutiny. And especially if it's a movement that's seeking to overthrow and Western society and kill people, it's imperative to do that. When you put people like that in the same category, you put them in the same bucket as actual kooks and racist and irrational people, what does that mean? Well, it shows that this concept is, there's nothing there. It's a putting together of fundamentally different things that don't belong together. And by putting them together, I don't think this is a mistake. I think there's some agenda here. But we'll take a quick break before we continue to analyze this report from the Southern Poverty Law Center.
The Ayn Rand Institute fights for your values. In the classroom, in the media, and around the world. From free Ayn Rand books for young people to ARI Campus, our overriding mission is to introduce as many people as possible to Rand's ideas. It's not easy, but you can help. Your support for ARI goes directly to educational programs that introduce young minds to the right ideas. Your support makes possible the emergence of student leaders and future intellectuals who will fight for reason, self-interest, and capitalism. Your contribution will usher in a future of rationality, freedom, and prosperity. To contribute now, visit AynRand.org/donate. Every dollar is important. Thank you. Every week on Radical for Capitalism, Yaron Brook discusses news, culture, and politics from the objectivist perspective. But if 1 hour a week just isn't enough for you, the Ayn Rand Institute's e-store has what you need. ARI's e-store is home to hundreds of courses and talks that will not only help you improve your understanding of objectivism, but also help you acquire the intellectual tools that you need to enhance your life. Listen at home, in the car, anywhere, to more talks by Ayn Rand, Yaron Brook, and other leading minds in objectivism, including Leonard Peikoff, Harry Binswanger, Edwin A. Locke, and Peter Schwartz. Shop the e-store today at estore.aynrand.org.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, why should we care? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn, and the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
If you're a teacher looking for compelling and intellectually challenging material for your students, the Ayn Rand Institute's Free Books to Teachers program is for you. This program provides free, yes, free, classroom sets of Ayn Rand's best-selling novels, Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, and Anthem, to teachers in the United States and Canada. All you have to do is commit to teaching the novels in your classrooms during this academic year. Join the more than 50,000 teachers who have already taken advantage of this unique educational program. To receive your free set of books, visit Ayn Rand.org/freebooks. A free comprehensive teacher's guide will accompany your order. Visit Ayn Rand.org/freebooks today.
If you want to learn more about Ayn Rand, her ideas, and their relevance today, subscribe to the Ayn Rand Institute's YouTube channel. It's loaded with hours of material exploring the objectivist perspective on topics ranging from religion versus reason, freedom of speech, and capitalism, to the pursuit of happiness, and much more. New videos are always being added, so subscribe today by visiting youtube.com/AynRandInstitute.
Welcome back. This is Ilan Jerno. I'm filling in for Yaron Brook on this episode. It's great to be with you. You can find me on Twitter at Ilan Jerno, E-L-A-N-J-O-U-R-N-O, and on Facebook, Ilan.Jerno. So I've been talking about the report that came out a while ago from the Southern Poverty Law Center on anti-Muslim extremism. And I've been arguing that if you take the advice from Ayn Rand to engage in philosophical detection, if you take her advice seriously to help guide your thinking, you will see that this is a report that traffics in a term, extremism in particular, and also Islamophobia, that is an illegitimate term. It's an invalid concept, and it pollutes our thinking. So I want to just wrap up this point by making a couple of just highlighting a couple of aspects here. So I've already mentioned that the report brings together people who don't belong together, and it tars them all as essentially crazies and irrational and racist in effect. And that happens by the nature of a term like extremism, because what it's designed to do it brings together things that should be kept separate. So bigotry and racism are irrational and they have no place in a civilized society. Criticism of ideas, any ideas, does and is necessary for a free society. And what extremism does here, and also the term Islamophobia, which I've talked about in other places, they do what you shouldn't, which is put together two things that are very different, and it is really just confusing. So Islamophobia, just to illustrate that, that puts together the idea that if you're critical of Islamic ideas, and especially the jihadist ideas, you are racist. And how does that logic work? It works by putting together a number of things which are actual bigotry, actual racism, actual hostility, irrational hostility towards people of the Muslim faith, along with the attacks that go along with the people carry out on those premises, with the kind of work of the people mentioned in this report, like Ayan Hirsi Ali and Majad Nawaz, who are trying to raise issues and engage in real critical thought and debate, which is necessary and important. But they're all lumped together, they're bundled together, and the crucial distinctions between them, these are rational people, these are irrational people, that is washed out and ignored. And I think that the same sort of thing happens here under the broader heading of extremism, anti-Muslim extremism. I don't think that you can take seriously a report or an organization that traffics in this kind of terminology. And here there's an interesting point Ayn Rand made on this sort of issue. And her specific words are worth quoting because they're wonderfully pithy. She said, "Don't bother to examine a folly, ask yourself only what it accomplishes." And of course, she's said that in a number of cases. And I think it's important to see that when you unpack an issue like this, like extremism or Islamophobia, it is clear, and people were right to be outraged at the way dissimilar intellectuals and writers were put together on this list, this blacklist. But I think it's important to see that it's not accidental or mistaken. It's part of the purpose here is to tar good people with the vices of bad people. So to put Ayn Hirsi Ali on this list is not, "Oh, sorry, we didn't really think it through." It's more like, we want to bring her down to the level of one of the kooks in here who is a kind of, I don't know what better term there is for it, but racist, who's really hostile to people precisely because of their background and their unchosen features. So in my view, the kind of the wider purpose, and some of it is admitted in the report, because the report is calculated to be a guide, a field guide to these people so that journalists can avoid them. So there's some admission that this is meant to be a gatekeeping kind of tool. Like, these are the people who don't belong in the debate. But I think more, there's more to it than that, because by having a report like this, whether journalists go to these individuals or not, whether they're taken seriously and get invited to debates and so on, what is now being put on the record by at least in the past reputable organization is that they have now this label attached to them. They are now extremists, they're Islamophobes. And as a result, it's a way to quickly silence them. It's a way to say, these people aren't part of the legitimate debate. We've already defined the outer limits, and these people didn't fit. They're in this. They belong with the kooks. So part of the evil here is to demean and unjustly tar people as irrational when they're not, and silence them. So it's to take good people who are doing important work and prevent them from doing that. I think that's a consequence of having really. I don't want to speak to the motives here because I haven't looked into this deeply enough, but it's clear that it's not an accidental fact that this is who they put on the list. So just to wrap up this point, in my view, the people were right to be outraged at the incongruous membership of this list, but it's wrong to think that this was somehow an error that should be regarded as an innocent error. There's definitely a motive here that's malign in my view. And it's important to see that. And part of what I've been sort of highlighting here is to get to see some of these things, it's important to really look at the terms and understand them and unpack them philosophically. And in effect, follow some of the advice that Ayn Rand has given on philosophical detection, and also in her other essays, but that one in particular, to redefine the terms, understand the concepts, and then secondly is to take seriously what does this look like? What's the purpose here, and what does it mean for thought? So that's one aspect that I wanted to talk about in terms of the framing of today's show, some of the value of philosophical detection. I want to turn to the other point that I raised earlier, which is it goes along with taking the terms of a debate seriously and taking them straight and understanding and trying to unpack the concepts, because that's a big part of what it means to think philosophically, is to look at the terms and not just take them as a given, but ask, what do they refer to in the world? The other part of it, and it goes along, essentially it's integral to doing the same thing, but I'm singling it out for today's show, is to look at the personal meaning of ideas and policies and philosophical statements and ask yourself, well, what does this mean for me? How would this look like if I took it and accepted it and lived by it? What would it do to my life? Would it make it better, worse? What is the impact in the real world? And this is central to Ayn Rand's view of how philosophy works and its importance in life. It should be a guide to life. Should be a guide to action, should guide you in selecting goals and values and organizing your life around them to achieve your own happiness. So if you're accepting a certain idea, it should fit with your outlook, it should fit with your goals. And if it doesn't, that's an important signal. And so when you encounter an idea, you want to think about what is its significance to your life. Take it personally and see and think it through. So I want to turn now to a couple of stories that caught my attention that I think are ways that they're important in illustrating how this works and how you can gain value from this perspective of taking philosophical ideas personally, which is, again, an aspect of philosophical detection and applying philosophy in your own life, and objectivist philosophy in particular. So the two stories I want to talk about. One is Cuba under Castro and the incoming Trump administration, specifically the rise of the GOP and its power now, and the connection between that and Poland and some of the story that I read about in Poland. Oh, I don't know how many people think about Poland in their day-to-day life, but I'm fascinated by world affairs and I track this. So let's start with the death of Fidel Castro, which got a lot of attention at the time, and now fortunately it's behind us. But I want to talk about this from the perspective of the meaning of the ideas he stood for. Because one of the issues that came out is there were all sorts of retrospectives. It was like in Cuba, and there was a whole kind of uproar over the statement by Canada's prime minister, which was viewed as, well, he's really kind to Castro. And there's a whole Twitter storm about what would it look like for Canada's prime minister to praise other world dictators. And people are right to be outraged at Castro's regime because it was horrific. What I want to talk about is the question, what does it look like? What is communism, the system that dominated so many countries in the 20th century and still through the present, it's a huge power in Cuba and in other countries. And so you might think, well, it's in the past, but I don't think the full significance and meaning of communism is real to people. And the death of Castro has brought to light a lot of stories about what Cuba was really like, still is like, under this regime. And so what I would suggest to you is that if you want to understand the world, you understand recent history, and you understand the world as it's and how it operates, you need to take ideas like this and really make them personal. What would it look like to live under Castro? What would it look like to live under communism? Because you hear all kinds of things, but the beginnings of real understanding are to take those ideas and concretize them, make them specific and personal, and see their significance. And that's part of what it means to take philosophy seriously. So the cash value here is to gain real depth of understanding about the world and about regimes like Castro's and about the importance of good ideas and what it looked like to advocate for them and to see what's wrong with bad ideas. And the bad idea here is it's communism or totalitarian communism. So just to give you a flavor of Castro, you've probably read some of these stories when they came out, but the reality of what Cuba was and in many respects still is just breathtakingly bad. So as you're hearing this, think to yourself, what would it look like for me to be trapped in Cuba? What would it look like in practice, in day-to-day life? And so there were many people in Cuba who ended up on the wrong side of the regime. Even if they tried to be compliant, the regime, as many of these are, sweeps people up as nonconformists. And you did not want to end up in a jail run in Cuba. Here's what happened to some people who were seen as nonconformists and needed to be broken. And literally they thought of this as breaking the prisoner's resistance. So in one of the jails or dungeons, they had something called a drawer cell. So a very small jail cell. And this was designed to really break someone's soul. So five or six, and this is a report I found in the Wall Street Journal, an account, it describes a cell in one of these dungeons as having five or six prisoners confined for days in a space that was basically very narrow and 6 feet long. So one of the prisoners who experienced this has said, we basically had to sit there, our knees against our body, there was no room to move. Prisoners had to urinate and defecate right in their space. I mean, just imagine being confined to that kind of space for what? For not thinking the correct thoughts, for not having paid obeisance to the dictator of Cuba, for not conforming to what is the official line, and until you were broken. So that's what it looks like to have to kind of remake human character in the form of a communist man, which was part of what the communist system tried to do in many countries. And this, I mean, you're right to think of this as torture, because I think it was torture, and it was designed to really inculcate and push into people's minds conformity to the doctrines of communism. So just think that when you hear about communism, when you hear people joking about communism, this is what it means. So I was watching Modern Family, the TV sitcom recently, and I haven't watched it in a long time, and I can't remember why I decided to watch it because I felt like it's deteriorating. But I watched it, and one of the characters, I think his name is Manny, he's the son, and he's going through a phase where he's pretending to be a communist, and they're making fun of him, and he's spouting all kinds of communist nonsense. But when I see that, to me, and it's right that the show is poking fun at him because they end up showing that he can't really live according to these ideas. But part of when I hear things like that, it to me is horrifying because clearly he's a child that he doesn't know well enough. But it's horrifying when people take these issues so lightly. The real meaning of communism in Cuba, in the Soviet Union, and across Eastern Europe, where they dominated through an imperialist campaign for many years, it is horrific. It's one of the worst evils of recent memory. So it can't be, in my view, it has to be taken seriously. And in the particular, what it looks like to an individual human being and the millions who were subjugated under this system. And the coverage of Cuba really brings this home. The other thing that you learn about in Cuba, which you hear, is that it's not a good argument, but it's often put up as, well, Cuba at least had good health care. Apparently, it's too sick to really believe that people would do this, but this is really what they did. They did not have good health care. That was, I think, just a PR stunt. And the way they would doctor the statistics to make it seem like it was a good system is if they felt like there were women whose children weren't going to do well, they would have state mandated abortions so that the infant mortality rates would look good, or at least as good as some other more advanced countries. Now just think of how corrupt it is to have a regime that tells you it's not your choice. We're going to decide this for you, and we're doing it to keep up the pretense that this system, which is we all know all around us, if we were honest, is soul destroying and crushing, and it creates incredible material ruin. We're going to pretend that that's all true, and in order to do that, we're going to have to monkey with the statistics, and that means you have to go under the knife and have this abortion. Now that's sort of the personal meaning of what it looks like to live under this kind of regime. So reading about Cuba and taking it in kind of in a personal way, like what does it look like to live under a communist system? One of the other things you can do to get your head around this is obviously read historical accounts, and history is a wonderful, if you can get good ones, history is an amazing way to see the playing out of ideas. And I want to give you a flavor of that. It's not just Cuba, it's the system, it's communism and how it works wherever it's applied. It's just a corrupt idea. And take another example that the stories about Cuba reminded me of, and that is the East German regime, which was formerly known as the German Democratic Republic. And you want to get that it's not just Castro went wrong in applying it. This is inherent in the system. So you need more data. So when you see this, I mean, I don't know how many people know this. More people did. So the East German regime came about after World War II, and it was essentially a satellite of the Soviet Union, and it became a police state like none other. In the modern era, that is just it brought that system of control to such levels of intensity. It's unbelievable. So at one point, the East German secret police had as many as 85,000 full-time employees, 60,000 unofficial collaborators, 110,000 regular informers, and as many as 500,000 part-time informers, and many of them didn't even know that they were in that category. So what the German regime would do is have husbands spy on their wives, professors spy on their students on their professors, priests on their parishioners, to the point where when the East German regime was dissolved, they opened up the records and they found files on 6 million residents in the country, which is basically one in three people. Now that is a regime that is seeking totalitarian control, and it really tried to that was its ambition, and you can tell by the scale of its secret police, this is, they took it seriously. And imagine living under that. Imagine like every step you're taking is being observed, and you have to observe other people, and you have to tell on them if they're acting against doctrine. I forget the term for it, but there's a really colorful German expression for standing out against official doctrine, not being sufficiently communist. And that's essentially what they did. They created a society of informants against each other, and worse. And in this connection, if you want to get sort of a dramatization of it, I'd recommend the movie. It came out, I think, in 2006, called The Lives of Others. And it's a dramatization of life in East Germany. And it's an amazing movie because it really brings into specific vivid reality what it looked like to live under that kind of domination by a regime. And again, the purpose of this is to see what it looks like personally to live under that kind of communist regime. And that's the personal significance. So when you hear people say, communism is great in theory, it's not, and it just failed in practice. That is, when you hear that, it's false. But you also see in real concrete terms that no, it's evil, and this is what it does to human beings, to individuals. It destroys them. It treats them as pawns, and it disposes of their lives as cheap. That was true of Castro. That was true in East Germany. That was true wherever this system was applied. So part of what I'm encouraging you to do is when you think about these issues or these philosophic ideas personally and see their significance in human life and research and understand them in concrete reality and understand them in their historical context. So that was brought to mind by the news of Castro. And it's not a moment too soon. He was a blight on civilization, and it's a good thing we're rid of him. Unfortunately, Cuba isn't still not a free place, not a free country, and I think that day has yet to come. So I want to turn to a final story that caught my attention that I think is another case where it's important to take ideas personally and concretely and understand their significance. And the issue here might seem on the face of it obscure. So I read a story about Poland and the kind of laws that they have about abortion. And it's really, it's heartbreaking what's going on there. But I think it has a direct relevance to what we have here in the U.S. So let's talk about what's going to happen under Trump. I have no idea exactly, but I know that to the extent there are people now in Washington looking to fill various positions and push their agendas and so on, this is now the scramble that will result in whatever it is that becomes the administration's priorities. And I would put good money on this assumption that there's a whole cluster of people pushing for, okay, here's what we want to do. We want to push Roe v. Wade out. We want to reverse it, knock it down. And how that takes shape, whether it's a direct push through the Supreme Court or if it's done at the state level through incremental steps that limit access to abortion by regulating clinics and so on. Who knows? I don't know exactly what their strategy is going to be, but I think that is a goal. There are definitely people who regard that as that has to be done. And I have never lived in a place where abortion was illegal, but I've thought about what would that look like. And I'm curious what that looks like. And it's important to think about what that looks like. There's a lot of material here to go on, and we can project it, and it's important to do that. But you can look at other places where it is illegal and see what life is like for the people there. So this is where the story about Poland comes in. So in Poland, there's an interesting historical progression or retrogression. So up until I think it was the 1990s, for many years abortion was allowed. The laws were more lax, permitted it under many more conditions than now. But since the 1990s, I'm looking at the story here to see the specific year. I think it was 1993. Yeah. In 1993, the Catholic Church of Poland, which is very powerful, they struck a deal with the government of Poland. They reached what is known, and this is in air quotes, the compromise. And basically what happened is they rolled back the law on abortion to the point where today there are very few cases where it's legal. So I think it's rape and incest. Or if there's an immediate severe threat to the life of the mother, I think there might be one other category. But basically, it's almost impossible. And not just because the law is so strict and there's so few provisions, but that doctors are afraid to carry out the procedure. They don't want to have the challenge subsequently of proving that, yes, this was really a life-threatening instance, or, yes, really, we had all the documentation to prove this was rape or incest. They don't want that kind of hassle, so it's very difficult. So it's essentially impossible to get an abortion. Now, let me just say this up front. I know not everyone agrees with my view that abortion should be, it's a moral right and it should be legally permitted. My view is that if you believe in the principle of individual rights, it follows that those two things are true, that it's a woman's right to decide what to do with her body. And it's legally, it should be permitted under the, it should not be prohibited and certainly should be permitted. Now, and it's a very difficult issue, and let's just acknowledge that it's a very difficult issue. I certainly don't want to be in a position to tell people, I don't want to be in a position of having to make that kind of choice, and certainly I'm never going to be pregnant, obviously, but I think it's a very challenging position to be in. So the point here is just to acknowledge that, and it touches nerves. I get that. Crucial that it be free and that people be free to carry out abortions and to seek them. And it's precisely because it's such a difficult issue and its impact on the woman's life is so significant that I think this is what's so terrible about the bans on it. So here's a story and its relevance to us. So Poland is essentially a place where the kind of people here who want to ban abortion, in Poland they've succeeded. And in Poland what you have now are women who either go underground to find sort of illegal places, or they have to go abroad, and some of them, and it's not cheap to travel. So they have to go, and one woman in the story had to go to Germany to carry out this procedure. And not only that, there's a whole social stigma attached to it. And it's the story tells of a number of women who've tried to break this, kind of push back on the stigma and make it such that people are aware of how difficult it is to live and carry out these kind of choices. They're having protests. Women are coming into the streets and saying, look, in one protest, there were at least 30,000 women coming out saying, well, we need to change these laws. These are crazy. Really sad stories of women and what they've had to go through. And when you read this, you think, okay, well, what if I lived in Poland? What if I lived in a society where the religious agenda of banning abortion was realized? It is not pretty. Whatever your views are now, I think it's important to see that it has a huge impact on an individual's life. And I won't tell you the whole story. I'll link to this in the show notes. But basically, it's so bad that women, bravely women in Poland, are taking to the streets to demand a change in the law and a great risk and cost to themselves. Now, the other perspective on this is there are the countries where it's illegal, almost impossible to get a legal abortion if the need comes up. And one of them, I think, is I think this is true still in Ireland and parts of Ireland. The Catholic Church is very powerful, and it's difficult, if not impossible, to get an abortion. And if you want to get a flavor of that, it's well worth researching. But think about this and its concrete significance to a person's life. What does it look like to have to go underground and take those kinds of risks? Now, on this, I would recommend an essay Ayn Rand wrote many years ago called Of Human Death, I think it is. And it's an analysis of a papal encyclical, so one of these essays by the Pope at the time. And it was on contraception, and the issue of abortion comes up. And in her analysis, again, what comes out of it, part of the way she views it is, well, think about this. And what does this mean about the view and its impact on human life? What does it mean to tell a woman that, no, it's not her choice. She has to live with this, and she has to bring into the world a child that was not planned or wanted, or under other conditions, a child she does not want at all. It's really powerful to think about it in those terms, because ultimately that is what of an abortion ban does. It harms and it violates the rights of women. When you think about those issues, I don't think abortion is one that's abstract to people, but it's very helpful to think about it's the flesh and blood individuals whose lives are affected by these kinds of laws. I'll link to the story about Poland, but so to wrap this up, what I'm encouraging you to do is, when you think about these issues or these policies that come along, is to look for real world instances of where they applied, what does it look like, and what does it look like in particular to individuals, and what would it look like if I had to live under this? What would my life look like? Could I succeed? Could I achieve the things I want to do? What would happen to me in certain conditions? What would be my options? And what would that mean for my life? That is part of what it means to look at the world and understand the ideas and policies and positions that people advocate, and to see their value significance to you and to your life. And to me, those are just some of the ways in which Ayn Rand's advice on thinking and on how to approach life in Philosophy Who Needs It, in the essay Philosophical Detection, and many of her other essays. That's part of what is so valuable, not just for me in my professional role, writing and speaking on these issues, but just to understand the world and understand the impact of philosophy on life, and especially good ideas. So that's, I want to draw a line there, and we'll take a quick break and come back with a few final thoughts.
You can see for yourself the day-in, day-out assault on reason throughout our culture. Collectivism, socialism, and an ineffective foreign policy are the direct result of the bad philosophy that all too many people, including our leaders, currently hold. The only antidote to bad ideas is better ideas. The only way to reverse the irrational philosophy we see everywhere is to fight for the right philosophy. That's Ayn Rand's philosophy, Objectivism, which proudly upholds reason, self-interest, and capitalism. ARI fights every day in defense of your values. We proudly uphold rationality, productiveness, and freedom. But we cannot do it alone. Join us in this critical fight. Support ARI today. Visit www.aynrand.org/support to learn more. That's www.aynrand.org/support. Thank you.
Free speech is under attack. Islamic totalitarians repeatedly threaten and kill those who offend them, while our leaders appease the attackers and blame the victims. College students seek trigger warnings and safe spaces to protect them from controversial ideas. The government harasses Tea Party groups for their political speech, and it investigates oil companies and advocacy groups for dissenting from climate change orthodoxy. Why is this happening? What can be done? Find answers in ARI's new book, Defending Free Speech, by me, Steve Simpson. Order it today on Amazon.
Join the 40,000 subscribers already connecting with ARI through our newsletter, Impact Weekly. You'll learn about our programs and discover our distinct perspective on today's most talked about issues. Whether you're a student interested in getting updates on ARI's essay contest, an Ayn Rand fan looking for ARI events in your area, or if you're simply looking to learn more about ARI's activities around the country and what we're doing to advance freedom, Impact Weekly is your go-to source for these and other timely updates. Visit AynRand.org/signup today.
15 years off to September 11th, Islamic totalitarianism is undefeated and on the march from Paris and San Bernardino to Brussels and Orlando. Our military strength is unmatched, and yet Islamic totalitarianism is still a menace. Why? ARI's new book, Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism, From George W. Bush to Barack Obama and Beyond, addresses this very question and the fundamental problem at its core. The book, a collection of essays from ARI experts Ankar Gatte and me, Ilan Jurno, highlights the irrational philosophic ideas that permeate and subvert American foreign policy. While the United States is indeed a military superpower, it lacks the moral certainty needed to defend itself and its ideals, and our political intellectual leaders evade the true nature of Islamic totalitarianism. After 9/11, ARI predicted that the prevailing ideas about morality would undercut our foreign policy, ultimately crippling us. Sadly, those predictions have proven to be correct. We can end the Islamist menace and secure our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, easily in fact, but we must adopt the right philosophic ideas to guide the way. Pick up your copy of Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism at Amazon today to learn more about this life or death issue.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, free minds. You can join their battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism here and around the nation by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support. That's AynRand.org/support.
Welcome back. This is Ilan Jurno. I'm sitting in for Yaron this episode, and you can find me on Twitter at ElanJourno and on Facebook. So I want to round out this show with a couple of quick updates and things that I regard as highlights of the year for me of 2016. So one is that in November, ARI hosted a conference called Ayn Rand Student Conference 2016. And I was one of the speakers. I also attended all the sessions that I wasn't speaking in. And I came away from that just energized. I can't say enough good things about this conference. The theme of it was free will and Ayn Rand's view of free will and how that has application and implications for your own life, your achievement of happiness, what it means politically, what it means culturally, what it means for psychology, a whole host of issues and applications. And it was fascinating. I mean, I met amazing students. It was, I think it was a breakthrough conference for us. The number, I forget exactly how many there were, but it was more than 140, I think, students attended. It was just the caliber of students was super high and impressive. The speakers, and I'm excluding myself here, but I mean, the other speakers I heard were just of a standard that is amazing. Now, so I hope some of the content of that will go up online, but you can read some about some of the details of the event on our website. We have a number of blog posts on it. We'll link to it in the show notes. And I think our ARI's annual report, which is coming out or will have come out by the time you hear this, has a feature about that. So I encourage you to read about this event. We're hoping to do another one next year, Ayn Rand Con, we're calling it. It is just an amazing occasion. And part of what's so energizing for me about it is it goes directly to what we do at the Ayn Rand Institute, which is to teach people about Ayn Rand's ideas, show them the value of those ideas and how they apply in individual life. And it was to an audience that is one of the most important audiences for us, which is people who are in college and high school and graduate school, students broadly construed. Because they're at the point in life where they have the time to think about it, they're motivated to think about those issues, they have the questions on their minds, and they are, to borrow the cliche, they are the future, and that's significant. So to me, this was a really exciting venture. I'm very proud to have been part of it, I hope you guys look into it. If you're a student, look for news about the next round. And if you're not a student, I'm sorry you can't attend. And I think that may be disappointing for some of you just because how good the event was. But it's an amazing thing, and I'm glad we the Institute put it on. I hope we'll do more of that. And this is essentially to tell you about it and also to just say thanks to all those who made it possible, because it takes a lot of effort, both on our staff, but especially the people who support the Institute who made this possible. We've got a number of donors who enabled us to do that. So thanks to them, just to recognize their contributions for that. So that, to me, that was one of the highlights of the year. And it was just a thrilling opportunity to meet so many bright students and hear such amazing talks. So that was a something I look back on fondly. Another piece of news I wanted to share briefly is I tweeted something recently saying I'm editing chapter 4 of my book, and somebody kindly asked me, "Why are you writing a book?" And then it occurred to me, yeah, not everyone knows that. So I wanted to tell you guys about it and maybe drum up some interest. So my book is, you might have heard in the commercial, I was involved in putting together Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism, which came out this year, which is another highlight. So that book looks at the last 15 years and the attempts to deal with the Islamist movement, the jihadist phenomenon. So the book that I'm talking about is a different one. I've been working on it for longer, and its scope is different. So that the new book I'm working on is about America's policy in the Middle East, specifically regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And when I tell people about that issue, they have often a reaction of, whoa, you're basically walking into what is notoriously unresolvable, hopeless, slash everyone's crazy kind of conflict. And I'm sympathetic to those views because there's something to it. There's ways in which it can look hopeless, and it's hard to tell where people should stand and who's right and who's wrong, because it's a very complicated issue. But part of what's exciting to me and what I think is part of the value of the book, if it's successful, is it brings clarity to that issue, and it specifically explains America's actual stake in that conflict. Because a lot of people, that's part of what's debated, like who cares on the one hand, and oh no, obviously we should side with, and then fill in the blank for the side that you favor. And there's obviously people who are very pro-Israel and people who are very pro-Palestinian, and then people who sort of, I don't know, so who cares? And then there's other views, but those are some of the common ones. And my view is that it's important to understand this conflict and understand America's stake in it. So the way I think of this book is its purpose isn't to just to say, here's what our policy should be, though there's answers to that. The purpose is deeper in that its goal is to say, here's the moral landscape. This is how people think of this issue. This is how they think about right and wrong and what's justice here. And the book is challenging the assumptions that prevail on that and saying, this isn't the way to think about justice. This isn't the way to think about how to understand the conflict, to evaluate the adversaries, to think about what resolution looks like. So it's more a moral critique than a political or policy critique. And I'm so the update, we're recording in early December, for those of you listening, and I'm making good progress. I'm on to editing chapter 5, and I'm envisioning 6 chapters. So I'm near the finish line, and I'm hoping to be done with this portion of the editing in the early new year, 2017. The question, if you're wondering when it's coming out, I wish I had the answer, because once the book is out, then it's over to sort of the process of getting a book published, which is, if you've ever looked into it, it is, you know, one part voodoo, one part luck, and one part nobody quite knows what. So I'm exaggerating, but it's really a difficult process. But the essential is once it's in that process, it's hard to predict how long it takes. Sometimes publishers move quickly, sometimes they don't. So my hope is that it comes out sometime in 2017, but it might take a bit longer. In any case, once I'm done, I'll be talking to Yaron on the show a bit more about the book and telling you guys more, previewing it and doing more writing and speaking about the subject of the book. So there's more to say. I just wanted to give you guys a preview and something to look just tell you what has kept me busy lately. So that's all I had on for today's show and update. I wanted to leave you with something that perhaps will give you some lift or some sort of positive, encouraging view of the world. You're going to inhabit a universe that's slightly different from ours through the medium of art. So I know Yaron has done movie recommendations and TV shows. I'm going to take a stab at that. And if he's already mentioned this one, then just take this as a seconding of his recommendation. It's a show that aired some time ago. I think it started on British TV. It's called The Paradise. And it tells the story of a department store in the late 1800s in the UK. And the main character is really what drew me to this show. She is a shop girl who rises up through her own wits and initiative and her creativity. And above all, I think her business sense, which is remarkable. And it's just a rare and well done show where the heroine really is someone admirable and assertive in a good, thoughtful, rational sort of way. And it's just a pleasure to see that. And this is a historical show, obviously. So if you like historical drama, then you will enjoy inhabiting that world. So that's the recommendation. It's called The Paradise. I think you can find it streaming on various platforms like Amazon and Netflix. So if you like it, let me know. You can tweet at me, Ilan Jerno. Share your thoughts on Facebook. And if you have any other comments or feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me on those, Facebook and Twitter. And it's been great being chatting with you today. I look forward to being on the show again. And good premises, as Ayn Rand used to say.